You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
Good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, friends and listeners of KPFK. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall, welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. Well, on March the 3rd, lots happened from the American Bar Association. Maria, tell our audience what we're going to be discussing tonight.
Sure. Well, along in the midst of our constitutional chaos out there, we're fortunate enough to have with us once again our resident constitutional law scholar, Stephen Rohde. And he'll be talking about how the courts and law firms are responding to attacks by the current administration. And he'll keep us updated on what's going on.
Yep, that's our full hour today because, my God, we've got more. Frankly, more than we can discuss in the hour, but we're going to do our best. As I said, on March the 3rd, the American Bar Association issued a rather important statement, I think, and I quote from it. And I should apologize for my voice. Again, a little froggy has decided that my throat is a good place to reside for a while, so I apologize for that. And I quote now from the ABA statement. The ABA rejects efforts to undermine the courts and the legal profession, close quote. They called upon the Trump administration to adhere to four major principles of law that have, they say, quote, guided our country for over 200 years, close quote. The four principles are to defend judges in the courts, to acknowledge the role of the courts, to adhere to the rule of law, and to respect the separation of powers and the three co-equal branches of government with distinct duties and responsibilities. These principles have, they state, been the quote-unquote bedrocks of American democracy. The ABA statement accuses the Trump administration of violating these principles in several ways. And so today, as Maria has indicated on the Lawyers Guild Show, we've asked our regular guest on constitutional matters to join us for the full hour to evaluate whether the Trump administration is, in fact, upholding or violating these principles that the ABA calls the bedrock of America's democracy. Our guest then is Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a constitutional scholar, writer, lecturer, and political activist. He is the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, the past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He is founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and is now a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Together with Maria and myself, Steve Rohde is also one of the co-hosts of our national public affairs show, Law and Disorder, which you can find at lawanddisorder.org. Of course, Mr. Rohde is speaking today only for himself. Well, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Maria. We've got to stop meeting like this.
If only.
It is such an important time to be delving into these issues, and thank you for having me again.
Oh, no, thank you, because you do a lot of work in preparation for these shows, Anna, so we thank you. All right, now, what is your reaction, first of all, to this hot case going on, the controversy over the case of the Trump administration invoking a rarely used, what is it, three times in the history of the country or something, a rarely used 227-year-old wartime law to deport hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants to El Salvador? The appeals court has now upheld the lower court's opinion, just today, in fact. And of course, the government had already filed an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Unhappy with the lower federal court's initial rulings, remember, this is the case where Trump labeled the judge a quote-unquote left lunatic judge and called for his impeachment. Chief Justice John Roberts was so moved by that that he felt he needed to issue an unusual statement defending the independence of the judiciary. So, Steve, tell us about the latest about this case. What do you think about Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 as justification for it, and what the court did just today?
Well, this is a remarkable time, and it's remarkable because of what Donald Trump has done entering his second term. He is taking a hatchet to the Constitution. He is destroying not only norms and standards, but express provisions of the Constitution. And he is assaulting our democracy. And it is such a crucial time to be paying attention to these issues. And any day that a court of appeals comes in with a decision against Trump and his administration is a good day. Each time we meet, we've had some good court opinions to discuss. Ultimately, it's going to get to the United States Supreme Court, and we'll be talking about that later. But I think it's worth taking a few minutes to look at this specific case. In the law books, it's known as JGG et al. Versus Trump. They're using the anonymous initials of a immigrant, a Venezuelan immigrant who was among over 200 that literally in the dead of night were flown out of the United States to this abominable prison in El Salvador that before all this had gained the criticism of Amnesty International and human rights groups for being an abominable prison. Apparently, the government, the U.S. government, paid $6 million to the government of El Salvador. It really is the new Guantanamo. And it's worth thinking about it in those terms. What Donald Trump is doing is worse than what George Bush did. And I'm not sure I ever expected to say those words in public. In the war on terror, George Bush thought he had hit upon a wonderful place at Guantanamo and rounding up Muslims across the world, never giving them a trial, but sending them off to Guantanamo on the sovereign property of Cuba. Now that was an outrage. You and I and the rest of the Lawyers Guild and the ACLU and groups across the country challenged that. We spoke against that in the broadest terms. It remains with about 35 men still in Guantanamo, one of the greatest acts of violation of human rights in American history. But this shipment of undocumented immigrants to El Salvador is different because those people were swept up from the territory of the United States. And while the laws vary on the due process rights of immigrants in the United States, there's no question that the Constitution applies to them. The laws apply to them. And therefore, what happened here is an outrage. And the good news is that our court system is recognizing that. The ACLU and others brought this case. It was randomly assigned to Judge James Boasberg, who saw it for what it was. That's the trial judge at the trial level in the U.S. District Court in D.C. And he issued an order to stop the deportations. And he even ordered that the planes be turned around as soon as he issued his order. Outrageously, the government, the Trump DOJ, would later argue that his oral orders from the bench were not binding. He later issued a 36-page written order. But the three of us as lawyers, any lawyer listening to the show, we have stood before judges. And when they order you to do something, it is a binding order. And on the moment of its expression verbally, you're expected to comply with it and to immediately advise your clients to comply with it. And this government did not do so. Those individuals were shipped off to this abominable prison. Judge Boasberg said, the opponents and the government were saying, we don't care, we'll do what we want. This is the abuse that we're discussing today that goes to the heart of our system. Tom Homan, a White House chief border official, said, we're not stopping. I don't care what the judges think. I don't care what the left thinks. We're coming, presumably coming for more people to ship them away. Well, all of this was done under the Alien Enemies Act. And with your permission, want to take a moment because I think your audience needs to understand that the Trump administration has reached back to a wartime law passed in the hysteria of our new nation's concerns of war with France at the time. And they passed the infamous Alien and Sedition Acts. And we're focusing on the one of the Alien Enemies Act. Thomas Jefferson called these laws laws that came from a reign of witches. These were outrageous at the time. And what the Alien Enemies Act said is that unilaterally, the President of the United States, either in time of a declared war or invasion entry into the United States or predatory incursion, the president could expel individuals that were part of that armed invasion. I'm going to jump ahead because we now have a court of appeals a few hours ago upholding Judge Boasberg's findings. He granted an injunction. And when you consider an injunction, you consider the likelihood of success on the merits. You consider the balance of injuries to the respective parties, and you consider the public interest in the case. And Judge Boasberg found all of those factors weighed in favor of the plaintiffs, these Venezuelan immigrants. And now two judges on the Court of Appeals have agreed with him, and they rejected the Trump administration's request to stay the injunction. They wanted to go forward to keep using the Alien Enemies Act. The main opinion today was written by Judge Karen Henderson. She was a George H.W. Bush appointee. She wrote an erudite 29-page opinion. The Court of Appeals interrupted my lunch today, and I've read this case. It's worth reading. It has the history of the Alien and Enemies Act fully displayed. And she was joined by Judge Millett, appointed by the Obama administration, who wrote a 41-page opinion. And there was a third opinion, essentially a dissenting opinion by Judge Walker, and he was appointed by Donald Trump. Now, The two judges, and I'll briefly summarize a lot of this. First of all, they cast aside Trump's DOJ's argument that this is a political question, and the courts have no right to tell the president what to do when he makes a judgment that these individuals were members of an international gang and that they were engaged in an invasion of the United States. Judge Henderson and Judge Millett just destroy that argument historically. And we've talked about originalism in these programs, this conservative notion that we are bound by the original text and intent of the U.S. Constitution when it was written, and that it does not adapt to future events. Well, I'm very eager to see how the Supreme Court handles this case, because these opinions upholding the injunction against the Trump administration were tailor-written to address originalism. They go back to the text of the Alien Enemies Act. They go back to the history and the surrounding circumstances to demonstrate that an invasion or predatory incursion is a military attack by a foreign nation on our country. It is entry and enmity combined together. And what the appellate judges do is to find that the text and its original meaning conflict with the government's opinion. They base it on the need for hostilities by a foreign nation, and they found none of this exist. So I'm pleased with this decision. It's important that we understand that due process has also played an important role in this case. No matter what law Congress passes, any law must bring with it due process. And Judge Millett emphasized that even more than her statutory interpretation of the enemy, the Alien Enemies Act. She said that none of these men rushed without a court hearing, without lawyers, without evidence.
Nothing.
There are published reports that the government was relying on tattoos as an insignia of this gang, when these were soccer tattoos and were common tattoos. Many people have come forward and said they saw their loved ones on these terrifying news videos where the men had been had their heads shaven and were being dragged around like animals in the El Salvadorian prison. There is so much that would have come out if due process had been granted to these individuals. So this is emblematic of what we're talking about today, the abuse of our Constitution and our laws. I regret that a presidential administration prior to this did not move to repeal the Alien Enemies Act. That shouldn't be sitting on our law books as the gun over the mantle, ready to be taken down at a moment's notice and used by a fascist president as it's being used right now. But the courts are fighting back, and that's what we're talking about today.
Wow, excellent. Thank you so much for that, Steve. What happened to Maria? My goodness. Anyway, something has happened to Maria. No doubt she'll get a chance to rejoin us. Steve, in that same deportation case you were just talking about, hasn't the Trump Justice Department rather cavalierly not only ignored the judge's orders, as you pointed out, violating the ABA principle, calling for the president to respect the role of the courts? Whenever Trump, in fact, gets a court decision he does not agree with, he claims the court is acting beyond its authority or has no right to rule as it did. Isn't all this deepening a already existing constitutional crisis?
It is, and this is what is so damaging right now. And the American people, I think, are waking up to this. And the Democratic Party is beginning to grow a spine and push back at it, although it has a lot to answer for not doing more than that. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump got a boost last year because this very Supreme Court gave him absolute criminal immunity in their decision in that case. This bolstered his ego, his personality, that he is above the law, because they literally, in the criminal law area, put him above the law. He has now created a second administration, populating it with sycophantic officials in every single department and deep into those departments that are doing his bidding. And they, in this case, they refused Judge Boasberg's order. He was patient. He wanted to know who these men were that had been deported. When were they deported? What was the chronology compared to the timing? And eventually, only a few days ago, they refused his order. They invoked a very dangerous doctrine called the state secrets privilege. This is an unwritten concept that the government has been promoting for years, that when something gets into the courts, if it affects national security and foreign affairs, the government can invoke a privilege. It's not in the law, it's not in the federal rules, it's not in any statute that Congress has ever passed. They can invoke a state secrets privilege to deny that information. Now, usually the lawyers go into the judge's chambers outside the public eye and they discuss the nature of the material. This government wouldn't even do that. And they have flaunted the order. It's outrageous. And fortunately, people are beginning to speak up against that.
But Steve, Trump has a response to that. Trump claims that since in his mind he's saving the country, by definition he isn't breaking any laws. Isn't he claiming to be above the law rather clearly when he does this? And doesn't that further inflame the constitutional crisis you say we're living through?
He is, and I think what you're alluding to is an outrageous statement he made about 10 days ago. He quoted Napoleon Bonaparte.
Right. Yes.
Who said, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." Listen to that. He who saves his country does not violate any law. It's an outrageous principle. And it simply comes from an era of dictators and monarchs, not an era of an American constitutional democracy. It probably received less outrage and condemnation than it should have, but unfortunately, too many are becoming habituated to this when it comes to Donald Trump. So we have got to use every institution available. Currently, the courts are the first bulwark against him, and by and large, they are working. Almost 30 injunctions have been issued against him. And that's what we've got to continue to support.
Well, Steve, the fourth principle cited by the American Bar Association calls for the administration to respect the separation of powers and the three co-equal branches of government. It would seem as though Trump doesn't respect the independent roles the Constitution assigns to Congress and the courts. For example, he shut down the Voice of America, canceled foreign aid that was appropriated by Congress. He's authorized Elon Musk to fire thousands of federal employees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to us about this and the impact it's having in the expanding constitutional crisis taking place.
Well, first of all, I don't want to limit my criticism to Donald Trump. There are many in Congress who are enabling him. Congressmen are asking for the impeachment of Judge Boasman by name and other judges. impeachment for the rulings they make, which are in the civil context absolutely immune from. You can't sue you. Every one of us here and elsewhere, we've had a lot of judges who've ruled against us, and we'd be happy to sue them. You can't sue a judge for their rulings, and you cannot impeach them for their rulings.
No.
But Congress wants to intimidate them from doing their job, so they rattle the impeachment sword. Well, your question raises a second point, and I took some time to prepare for today. How can courts enforce their own orders? Many people, I'm active in a group called Indivisible up here. We've been active at the ACLU and other organizations, and people literally yesterday stopped me and said, well, what can we do? And I want to very briefly reassure your audience, there are remedies to what is going on if Trump further abuses his privilege or ignores courts more than he and his underlings are doing. There is contempt of court, and it was codified the same year, 1789, in the Judiciary Act. There's civil contempt and there's criminal contempt. Now, remember, there are a lot of underlings who are enforcing what Trump is doing. So Trump is not he may need the name of these cases, and he is subject to the jurisdiction of the court, but so are the lawyers, so are the heads of departments, so are the secretaries of various cabinet offices, and every one of them can be subject to contempt of court. Civil contempt can involve a daily fine. Let's not remember there was someone named Donald Trump in New York State Court who was sanctioned $10,000 a day for a total of $110,000 to force his legal team to submit explanations for not turning over documents in one of his cases. So we do have that power. We have criminal contempt. And criminal contempt has been used against government officials. And some of them have briefly been held in jail. Now, the courts are reluctant to do this, and they often excuse officials because they acted in good faith. But it is on the law, and there are strong norms that expect people to abide by the law. I do have to say, sadly, that criminal contempt is subject to presidential pardon. He could, and many of you will remember in 2017, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio was found in contempt for violating a court order to stop detaining suspected undocumented immigrants. You see, it keeps going on. And Donald Trump pardoned him from that. But some officials in 1997 and 2008 have been jailed, and other steps have been taken. You can also sanction the lawyers. Let's not forget that Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman and others have been disbarred and suspended. You can be suspended and disciplined for conduct unbecoming a member of the bar, and you can lose your license. U.S. Marshals are empowered to enforce these orders. And I was pleased to see that a judge can appoint a private attorney to prosecute criminal contempt. If the U.S. attorney declines to do so. So there are remedies. There's power left in the courts to stand up to this government if it has the audacity to flaunt government rulings.
Well, before I ask my next question, I think we ought to take our station identification break right now. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. We'll be right back with you, friends.
Hello, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Well, and we are back with you. That was a fairly short station ID break. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. And we're devoting our entire hour on the show today to a discussion with Steve Rohde, the constitutional expert that we have on more and more these days, because we're critiquing what is going on in the courts and the reaction of the Trump administration to the defeats that more and more they are getting in the courts, and their abuse and their failure to do what in our society of law and order they are supposed to do. And Steve, in fact, the next question has to do again with the ABA statement having to do with respect for the rule of law. It insists that Trump must be upholding and must uphold the rule of law. But instead, he's been threatening, well, now let's talk about law firms that previously represented parties in lawsuits against him, as well as those judges he wants to get impeached and so forth. He's targeting these lawsuits because they've either been, as I say, handling cases against him or advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion, perhaps, in their own law firms. And just this week, he signed a memorandum to hold attorneys and law firms accountable for, quote unquote, unethical conduct. Now, of course, he defines unethical conduct as a decision against him when litigating against the federal government or pursuing baseless partisan attacks. The memorandum instructs the attorney general to engage in a number of disciplinary actions in such cases. How do these actions threaten the rule of law, that which Trump is doing with respect to law firms? And of course, now some members of Congress are even going so far as to suggest they want to move to get rid of courts that are repeatedly ruling against the Trump administration. Surely knowing show respect, as ABA calls for the respect of the principle of law and the courts.
Yes. You know, Shakespeare said, kill all the lawyers.
Yeah.
He actually had those words in the mouth of an idiot. So while I was practicing law, I took some solace in that. But now it's attack the lawyers, attack the law firms, threaten them. Donald Trump issued executive orders with all of the power of the presidency against specific named law firms, condemning them, and their sin was that they had represented parties in lawsuits against him, had represented Jack Smith in his prosecutions of Trump. And when you stop and think about it, it goes to the heart. If we start attacking the lawyers themselves, then you are undermining the entire system, because all of these cases, and I'm at 127 lawsuits, many are filed by the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights and wonderful nonprofit organizations. But often those cases are supported by large law firms that have the associates, the research capabilities, and the resources to fund and sustain these lawsuits. This is a deliberate attempt to undermine the rule of law by cutting these law firms at the knees. Now, fortunately, there have been moments of profiles and courage in this area. A law firm known as Perkins Coie was attacked in one of these cases, and they fought back. They hired another prominent Washington firm, Williams and Connerly, to represent them, go in, and they got a court order from a judge who was appalled at what Trump had done. But then there's the sad case of Paul Weiss, a longstanding prominent New York City law firm. And instead of fighting, using all the prominent lawyers that they've got, hundreds of lawyers, to fight this case, given the example they saw of Perkins Coie fighting back, instead they capitulated. They entered into a corrupt agreement with Trump that he would drop his executive order. You know, he has a piece of paper typed out, and he signs it with a Sharpie, And that is so intimidating to this law firm that for the sake of withdrawing that piece of paper, they offered $40 million in pro bono legal services to causes that Trump chooses. This is a disgrace, and it has been condemned by bar associations, by associates in bar law firms, by organizations across the country. And I think that law firm will have a stain on its reputation for years to come. It is just the kind of appeasement. You cannot appease a bully. And when the bully has all the strength and force of the United States government, when you have the means at your disposal, you have to go toe to toe, because there are much smaller law firms. There are fledgling firms and others who may not afford and can't afford to do that fight. So that's the battle. I think hopefully more and more law firms will stand up. We're already seeing that. And you just hinted at another concern, which is Congress's power to limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts. This will probably be worth more attention at a future show when this is fleshed out in Congress. If Republicans try to limit judges like Judge Boasberg from issuing preliminary injunctions, and it'll play itself out in terms of Supreme Court jurisdiction. Unfortunately, the Constitution does allow Congress to set the parameters of federal jurisdiction. It's been done a few times over the course of the history. Fortunately, a case in 1872 said Congress cannot dictate a rule of decision. They can't dictate the outcome of a case or cleverly write a law that dictates the ruling itself. But we're in for a deep concern if the Republicans begin to implement limits on the courts.
Well, Steve, let's look at some of the other recent controversies and cases to see what, if anything, they tell us about the impact of the Trump administration on the constitutional governance of the U.S. For example, can you update us on the case of Mahmoud Khalil, the graduate student at Columbia University who led the pro-Palestinian protests on that campus and then was arrested by ICE? What's the latest in his case, and what are the implications for free speech, due process, academic freedom, and the limits on presidential power?
The implications are no less than terrifying. This is one of the most head-on attacks on campus free speech than we've seen in generations. We didn't even have this kind of direct assault in the McCarthy era. This is new McCarthyism, but it's new Trumpism. We have to find a better name because it's more dangerous and it is more sweeping. And the first prominent individual to be attacked was the pro-Palestinian demonstrator Mahmoud Khalil, doing nothing more than organizing and speaking at protest rallies on the campus at Columbia. And I'm sad to say that's where I went to law school. I have protested already to the law school administration for not speaking up against the larger university administration. It's deplorable, and we'll talk about Columbia in a moment as well. Khalil has the benefit of a court order. In the dark of night, he was stopped by ICE agents when he was with his pregnant wife. He is a permanent resident with a green card and student visa. He was purposely whisked away to Louisiana. They couldn't find him a bed in New York or New Jersey facilities. No, they did it to keep him away from his family, away from his lawyers. A court order has been issued to return him to New Jersey, and those proceedings are pending. Fearing that their case was falling apart, the government on March 24th amended the indictment. They realized that they were indicting him for his free speech. So they added that he, when he made his application for his immigration status, they accuse him of not mentioning an organization he was a member of, a United States agency and that helps Palestinian refugees, and that he failed to disclose work he had done for the British government in 2022. They are trying to scramble to find grounds to remove him that don't so clearly implicate his First Amendment rights. This case has all of the markings of a direct attack on free speech and academic freedom. The government is trying to distort pro-Palestinian activism into support for terrorism. This is so typical. It was true in the 50s when it was communism. Now it's terrorism. You try to associate someone with terrorism and then you try to expel them. So unfortunately, this case is spreading because another Columbia student, Young Seo Chung, a 21-year-old junior at Columbia, who has lived in the United States since she was 7 years old, and a judge has had to block her deportation on March 25th because she was accused of being an advocate for violence and terrorism. And Judge Naomi Rice Buchwald issued that injunction. A young man named Grant Miner has been expelled from Columbia. The cases go on, and that's what we are facing at this very moment.
Well, moving ahead a bit, many legal experts, Steve, and constitutional scholars like yourself, are greatly concerned with Trump's decision and what he's doing with respect to certain colleges. And you mentioned Columbia in the case of Khalil. The decision to cancel Columbia University's funding to the tune of $400 million. Was that a constitutional act? And what was your reaction to how Columbia has responded to it?
This was another overreach by the president. Using an executive order, he threatened Columbia. He said that they weren't sufficiently policing anti-Semitism at college rallies. Now, the truth is, at Columbia, at UCLA, and elsewhere, the one form of DEI that Donald Trump enforces is against what he calls anti-Semitism, and which many of us understand to mean criticism of Israel and their conduct in Gaza and the West Bank. He's conflated all of that, and he is coercing or attempting to coerce Columbia University by threatening their $400 million federal grants that go to their scientific research, their medical research. Now, this is a brutal threat. And my research does not show that Columbia has filed any lawsuits to restrain that threat and to have a court review the unconstitutionality of it. Instead, Columbia is kowtowing to Trump, is negotiating that $400 million figure, and is coming and genuflecting to him to say, oh, we are doing a lot to combat anti-Semitism. Look what we're doing to Mahmoud Khalil and the other pro-Palestinian protesters. This is an alchemy of dangerous proportions. This is the mixture of both suppressing free speech on the one hand by threatening to withdraw funds, which, by the way, are allocated by Congress and which the administration under the Impoundment Act is required by law to disperse and appropriate. So we're going to have to see a lot more courage from many of these universities across the country if they are going to be the true champions of academic freedom and institutional freedom. We're not seeing that from these campuses, and I am deeply concerned, as is the American Association of University Professors, faculty organizations, and student organizations across the country.
Well, Steve, what about the arrest and deportation of the undocumented high-profile activist and mother of four, Jeanette Vizquera, in Colorado? On Friday, a federal judge issued an injunction to prevent her deportation as her case works its way through the legal system. Talk to us about that case, please.
This is another example of selective enforcement. They claim there are 11 million illegal aliens in the United States, and they find a woman in Denver, Jeanette Vizquera, who came from Mexico in 1997. She's now the mother of four. She was an immigration activist. She was speaking out on immigration rights. For periods of time, she sought refuge in churches in Colorado. She has it's a very difficult history. I tried to work myself through the history of various rulings and orders and deportation orders and the like. But on March 17, she was detained. And on March 21st, District Judge Nina Wang ordered federal authorities not to transfer Ms. Vizquera out of Colorado. A hearing is set for this Friday in that case. And Time Magazine identified her as one of the world's most influential people in 2017 for her immigration work. And yet the Trump administration has singled her out when they say they only are going after the worst of the worst. This is the woman they have gone after. Fortunately, immigration groups are rallying to her defense. She is getting a modicum of due process. And we are eager to see what happens at that hearing this Friday.
Steve Rohde, most, if not all of the cases and issues we've been talking about today, well, certainly a likely number of them, are going to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. And in fact, are already in the process of weaving their way through the court, at least in the preliminary stages. What do you think we can expect from a court dominated by six conservative Republicans? Lower courts have been ruling against these often outrageous actions on the part of the Trump administration. Can we expect that same reaction from the Supreme Court or not?
You know, stay tuned. It is one of the greatest risks that Trump will be returning to this six super conservative majority court. This is the court, and I mentioned earlier, that granted him absolute criminal immunity in that 6-3 decision. There are justices on this court who believe in the unitary executive theory that the president sits atop the government with the highest and broadest power that even Congress cannot limit. When Congress passes laws that there can be inspectors general, that they have a 5-year term, that there has to be good cause to terminate them, Trump has been violating all of those principles. He is eager and hungry to tee up a case that will bring to this sick supermajority the quintessential case that will allow his lawyers to argue that Congress cannot pass these laws that tie his hands, as against many decisions that say that these are three co-equal branches and that the president is bound by certain congressional rules. Now, I've said that By the same token, Justice John Roberts is equally hungry for his legacy. He is hungry to be seen as a fair-minded judge. He took the unprecedented step of, without naming names, of criticizing Trump and others for calling for the impeachment of judges for their rulings themselves. He is yearning to be respected in Washington and in the annals of Supreme Court history, and I'm banking a lot on that. We do see cases, and in the last month, there was a case in that Dellinger case, the special inspector general, who unfortunately resigned, so the case was not fully heard on its merits. But in the interim, they were upholding a stay in that case by a slim majority, but it combined some of the conservative justices with the liberal justices. Recently, yesterday, or this morning, in a ghost gun case, 7-2, written by Neil Gorsuch, one of the conservatives, interpreted a statute to require background checks for ghost guns in a 7-2 ruling. So you see these rulings every so often where the judges show some independence. They show that they're willing to rule against the Trump DOJ in that case. And they even overturned the Fifth Circuit to reach that decision. So I'm reading the tea leaves. I'm eager to see a case on all fours that gets up to the Supreme Court. It will be a real test. It could be this Alien Enemies Act case that we spent some considerable time on today, because that's teed up now in the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court is the next level.
Mm. Well, Steve, what are your final thoughts about how the people here in the U.S. are or should be reacting to everything we've been discussing today?
I think the people have to speak up. I think the Constitution, although it was so deeply flawed, began with the words, "We the people." And I think there are many opportunities for that. I think it starts with information, and that's why I am so proud of KPFK, of the Lawyers Guild show, of our national show Law and Disorder, of the kind of independent journalism you're seeing online in The Guardian and other newspapers, and I won't list them all here. You are seeing independent, outspoken journalism, even if you're not seeing it as much elsewhere. So I think independent journalism allows us to learn what's going on, to empower us. But we have to do the rest. Lawsuits are necessary, but not sufficient. I was at a rally in support of postal workers this weekend, and those were occurring around the country. Jim, through my group, Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, organized an extraordinarily successful rally in front of Tesla. Up here in Sonoma County, I'm going to be out at a Tesla location on Saturday at a rally. There's going to be a nationwide protest on April 5th that everybody should join in. We got to speak to our elected officials. We got to applaud them when they do the right thing, and we've got to criticize them when they do wrong. We've got to go to those town halls or convene them ourselves. Take delegations to meet with them or their individual aides and assistants. We've got to make phone calls and postcards and petitions. There is this major election on April 1st in Wisconsin that could tilt that Supreme Court. And Susan Crawford is the candidate who stands up for the Constitution in Wisconsin. There are three special elections in Arizona's 7th district in September, and two districts in Florida also on April 1st. And there's so many ways we can be back here in California and still support the side that opposes the MAGA candidates in those courts, in those states. We've got midterms coming up that we got to get organized with right now. And we've got to donate to Indivisible and the ACLU and other organizations. We got to support state attorneys general when they do the right thing to sue the government. You know, it was Benjamin Franklin who said, we must all hang together, or most assuredly we shall all hang separately. Mm-hmm. He meant we have to stand together, shoulder to shoulder. That's why I'm proud to have been recently appointed special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment by the Muslim Public Affairs Council. So many of us began the Trump first term by opposing the Muslim ban and standing with the direct victims of this administration. They're doing the very same thing again this time. We've got to be equally stalwart and resistant to what is happening. If we do that, I believe we can turn back, we can neutralize this administration, we can get to changing Congress and the Senate, and eventually putting this man out of office.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left, Steve. Before we let you go, remind our listeners where they can follow your work, because it isn't just here on the Lawyers Guild show that where people maybe here's where they hear you, but mostly, but they can also read what you're doing because you write a great deal. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you. I've been great. I am grateful to LA Progressive. Dick and Sharon there produce such an extraordinary newspaper. I hope everybody subscribes to it online, and they are always accommodating in getting my materials out quickly and into the press. The same is true of Truth Dig. I have a major piece coming out on the attack on diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility on Truth Dig. I write for Ms. Magazine. It's Ms. Media, Ms. Studios, that is launching my first podcast, Speaking Freely, Exploring the First Amendment with Stephen Rohde. And I'm giving a plug right now to my own podcast, which will be released in a few weeks. So thankfully, because of the media and online publications, there's many ways to reach me. And I hope I've deserved another invitation to the Lawyers Guild show.
Oh, my friend, I wish it wasn't needed, only because I wish the country was going in a different direction. But we will have you back, I can assure you. Until next week, though, at the same time, that's it for today. I'm Jim Lafferty on behalf of myself and Maria Hall. And we thank Steve Rohde so much, of course. We thank all of you for listening. We hope you'll join us again next week. In the meanwhile, you stay healthy, my friends. And also, as Steve has urged you to do, and Maria and I join in that, make sure that you stay active and continue to stand up for your rights.
Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Children affected by the Los Angeles wildfires are facing difficult times. You can help comfort them by reading them stories.
Los niños afectados por los incendios forestales en Los Ángeles están pasando por tiempos difíciles, pero usted puede ayudar a llevarles un momento de alegría leyéndoles cuentos.
Families in Schools Read LA is looking for volunteers to support young children through reading, especially at shelters in Altadena, Pasadena, and Pacific Palisades.
La organización Families in School Read LA está reclutando voluntarios para leer cuentos a niños afectados por los incendios, especialmente en albergues de Altadena, Pasadena y Pacific Palisades.
Information is available by emailing Sandy Mendoza at smendoza@familiesinschools.org. Families in School is a not-for-profit 501c3 organization.
Para recibir más información, mande un correo a Sandy Mendoza a smendoza@familiesinschool.org.
This message is brought to you by Radio Bilingue Public Radio.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting the Cy Anantum Devotional Ensemble on Sunday, April 13th at the Nimoy. Presented in partnership with the Hammer Museum, this evening of music, readings,